You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Manaus is the capital city of the state of Amazonas in the north of Brazil. It has a population of 2.5 million. The city leans on one side along the Rio Negro and meets on the other side with the Rio Solimões.
Solimões.
Yeah, I almost got it right. To form the Amazon River, it is the most populated city of the Amazon rainforest, although it's still not well developed. 25% of homes do not have running water. 90% lack sewage treatment. In 2014, journalist Chris Feliciano Arnold traveled to Manaus to report on the World Cup. Captivated by what he saw, he spent the next 3 years investigating indigenous tribes, political corruption, and the drug war in the region. In his new book, The Third Bank of the River, Power, Survival in the 21st Century Amazon, published by Picador, he tells a gripping story of life in the Amazon. Chris teaches writing in the MFA program at the University of San Francisco. His work has appeared in The Atlantic, Harper's, and The New York Times. He's the recipient of a 2014 Creative Writing Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts. Where you found the time to write this book, I don't know, Chris. But Chris Feliciano Arnold is here. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So why did you decide to tell the story of the Amazon?
Well, I've always had a very profound but mysterious connection to Brazil. I was actually born there and adopted from Brazil as an infant in 1981, so at the twilight of the military dictatorship there, and brought to live in rural Oregon, to live an otherwise very ordinary American life. And for me, Brazil had always occupied this great mystery in my life, but yet for a lot of us here in the United States, it's a country that we don't have a very broad conception of beyond, of course, people know Rio de Janeiro, people know soccer, people know samba. But personally, I didn't return to the country where I was born until I was 25 years old. I was an adult at the time. It was really important for me to go back to the country on my own and sort of take a spirit quest, if you will, to get to know my country of origin. And on that trip, I was born in the south of the country, in the city of Belo Horizonte. But I traveled throughout the country that summer, and of all the places that I visited, the Amazon just struck me as just such an incredible and captivating place. And I was really struck by the gulf between the myth of the Amazon that we're so familiar with through the media, through movies, through books, and so forth, and what I actually saw there on the river.
And before we get to that, so you were, as you said, you were adopted as an infant, to parents. You go off to rural Oregon.
Yeah.
They told you you were born in Brazil.
Absolutely.
You knew you were from Brazil. And so.
Absolutely. Very. My family, not only my immediate family, my mom and dad, my brother, my extended family, it was never. It was always completely out in the open and something to be excited about. My family was always very eager to introduce me to Brazil and introduce me to parts of the culture of the country where I was from. But learning about Brazilian culture in Oregon is kind of like trying to find a snowball in the Amazon. There's just not much to go on. And even when I was in college at the University of Oregon, Portuguese classes, for example, were sort of like an extra credit class only Spanish majors could take as sort of like a supplement to their Spanish study. So even encountering the language of the country I was born was difficult growing up. But my family was always very supportive. But nonetheless, when you think about Brazil, at least here in the United States, in the Western imagination, so much of it is focused on Rio. So much of it's focused on Sao Paulo. So I just remember as a kid, Brazil was really just a country of the imagination. I had so little to go on, and so it wasn't until I made the trip there myself that it really just brought home to me the complexity of the country.
Well, and as you said before, I cut you off. There are misperceptions and misconceptions that Americans have about Brazil. So, what are some of those misperceptions, and what misperceptions did you have? Because as you said, first time to Brazil was when you were 20, as an
25.
Adult, you were
25. I was even at 25, I was so naive in terms of what I was going, what the sheer complexity and diversity and enormity of Brazil. So for me, I think growing up, we're so accustomed to thinking of Brazil through the lens of Tropicália, that it's sort of this paradise in the tropics, and the, so many of the iconic images of Rio de Janeiro, for example, are ingrained in the American imagination of Brazil.
Sugarloaf Mountain.
Sugarloaf Mountain, yeah. and of course, and don't get me wrong, I love Rio. Like anyone like anyone who's been there, it's an incredible city. But for me, I was just struck by the sheer diversity of the country, not only in terms of its geographic scope, but also its incredibly rich history. And one thing I've come to appreciate over time is how much of that history overlaps with our history here in the United States, whether we're talking about slavery or genocide or migration. It's just such a rich and varied history that I feel like doesn't always get that, some of those more nuanced stories and more complex stories about Brazil don't get told.
And so that's Brazil writ large. Now, what are the misperceptions about the Amazon?
Exactly. So the Amazon, I must confess, when I was growing up, everything I learned from the Amazon was in the VHS rack at the video store. Back for those of us who are old enough to remember renting.
Yeah, right.
And so for me, the Amazon was just this sort of dark and dangerous place, populated by hostile tribes, in a place where you know, people went looking for adventure, and people your typical Indiana Jones running from boulders, trying to grab treasure from the temple sort of iconography. And so obviously now looking back on that, it's so naive and such a basic view of such a complex region. But as a kid growing up, as a child of the 80s, there just wasn't that much to go on in an era when, you know, that was in the era of like Encyclopedia Britannica. Like, even if you were a curious kid, that wasn't the sort of thing that you could Google or YouTube your way into a more sophisticated understanding. So for me, probably the biggest misconception was that it was this sort of vast and dangerous and unoccupied jungle. And over the course of writing this book, I really even consciously tried to even stop using the word jungle. And stop even thinking about it as a jungle, and all the historical baggage that comes along with that sort of conception of what is really the world's largest forest, the world's largest river, and this incredibly and this remarkably diverse and critical region in the world.
Yeah, I would add to your misperception of the Amazon, mine would be filled with anaconda and piranha.
Absolutely, absolutely. The insects, snakes, flies, like all manner of creatures and vines and thorns. And that for me, even as I, not only as I was reporting on the book, but as I was writing the book, I really tried to work against that. With so much of the Amazon that is accessible to us here is that sort of Planet Earth Discovery Channel special of the incredible environment and biodiversity there. But for me, in creating and telling the story of this book, I really wanted to go past those aspects of the Amazon that we're familiar with and try to get to the human landscape and focus on the people there.
So let's talk about the title of your book. It's The Third Bank of the River. What's the meaning of the title? Why did you choose that as your title?
Yeah, so that title is a borrowed title from a classic Brazilian short story, A Terceira Margem do Rio. And for me, it's that story doesn't take place in the Amazon. It takes place elsewhere in rural Brazil. But it's a fantastic and fabulous story of life and death in the interior of Brazil. And in addition to just being a wonderful and lyrical title, I just thought for me it captured a certain spiritual element that I feel when I'm on the river. And so I hope the book lives up to that title, but it is an homage to one of the great Brazilian authors, João Guimarães Rosa.
Why did you choose to start the book flying into Manaus for the 2014 FIFA World Cup?
Yeah. So much of, in trying to introduce readers to this world, I really wanted to sort of use my own experience as a traveler there and allow myself to serve as a stand-in for the reader in some ways, and allow readers to kind of follow along in my journey of understanding and moving from naivety to understanding of the complexity of the Amazon. And for me, the book is it's bookended by the 2014 World Cup on one end and the 2016 Olympics in Brazil on the other end, where Manaus hosted as well some Olympic soccer games. And for me, those moments, which were so enormous for Brazil, so enormous for the Amazon rainforest in terms of a global spotlight focused on the region seemed to me narratively and just in terms of reporting really good entry points for mm-hmm. readers to get to understand the place through the eyes of an outsider. And that for me in writing the book was also another delicate balance, is trying to learn and investigate as much as I can while also recognizing and being conscious of myself as an outsider there mm-hmm. at all times.
You know, when planning for the World Cup, Brazil's president at the time, Lula da Silva, he insisted that matches not only be in Brazil's famous coastal cities, as we've been mm-hmm. talking about, like mm-hmm. Rio, but also in Manaus. Why was that important to him?
Yeah, and it was an incredibly controversial decision at the time, and one that the powers that be at FIFA were not entirely on board with. They were assured that they felt strongly, the FIFA organizers felt that matches in such an interior city in the Amazon would be a disaster. For Lula, I believe it was important for him to have a World Cup spectacle that showcased all of the different regions of Brazil, including what he might characterize as like the forgotten regions of Brazil, and make it an event that showcased the forgotten places and people of Brazil. And for Lula, whose personal story himself, he was from a region of Brazil in the Northeast that he hailed from one of those forgotten regions of Brazil and became, obviously, his legacy is very much in question right now, but right. became an enormous icon and figure of transformation for the country worldwide. And so I believe the decision to host World Cups in Manaus, World Cup matches in Manaus, as controversial as that was a gesture toward being inclusive of the Amazon region, being inclusive of the interior of the country in part of this centuries-long project of nation building in Brazil. And in a way, the construction and the excitement and the rush to develop for the World Cup is an echo of decades of similar systemic efforts to try to integrate the Amazon, whether through highways or economic development or other programs that the government has tried to do over the years to try to bring the interior into mm-hmm. the rest of Brazil.
What was the reaction of people in Manaus to this decision to bring the World Cup there? You talked to one resident, Moises Martins, mm-hmm. who said that his assessment of the event was that this is for rich people. Mm-hmm. Was that was he the typical resident of Manaus that, great, FIFA is here, but this isn't for me?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most interesting things about Manaus is just the incredible socioeconomic inequity in that city. It boggles the mind how Brazil has been able to take this forest capital and create a city that has so many of the creature comforts that might be afforded to the upper class anywhere else on the planet. So whether we're talking about food truck festivals or microbreweries or a Nike store or a luxury mall, all that is there for the taking in Manaus if you have the means.
In the Amazon.
I mean, for example, I've played in Texas Hold'em tournaments in the Amazon. It's at sports bars where they have a parking spot reserved for Tiger Woods in case Tiger Woods ever happens to be in the Amazon. But there's for a certain upper class in Manaus, this truly has, I imagine, been a miraculous decade of growth and development. And I think for that class of people in Manaus, the World Cup in many ways was a commemoration that the city had arrived at a certain level.
A validation.
Yeah. And yet for people like Moises and for other people who I spoke to in the book who do not have the means to engage and who in many cases do not have running water, basic, what we would consider here in the United States, basic services. So the gentleman you referred to in the book, I was visiting him as he was showing me images of his entire house being flooded by the river during the high season with, you mentioned anacondas earlier, snakes swimming through his living room where his children live. And for him, that's just a routine passing of the season. But yet I was prepared to interview him and to get to know his family and have them be, as I was, completely resistant to the World Cup. This is just development gone awry. This stadium's a white elephant. Instead, I was surprised to find that he and his family, they couldn't afford to go to the stadium, but they could afford to go to what was called Fan Fest, which was the sort of publicly open celebration where they had big screen TVs and live music and all sorts of publicly available festivities for anyone in Manaus who could afford the bus fare to get there. And I asked him if he's watching the games, if he's going to FanFest, and he did. And he told me it's because as much as he realizes that the cup is for rich people, he also realized that for his children, they would never see anything like this again.
I'm speaking with Chris Feliciano Arnold about his new book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. And this is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Chris Feliciano Arnold about his book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. It's out from Picador Press. And Chris, you were talking about, you alluded to this before, about the ways Brazil has tried to integrate the Amazon into the larger country. And you know, it makes me wonder about the folks who live in the Amazon, the indigenous people, some of whom want to keep their distance from so-called modern life. The Axaninka of Simpatia, that's one of the largest indigenous tribes in South America, right? Yeah. How large is this tribe?
And their territory actually spans not just the Brazilian Amazon, but also into Peru. And one of the things that struck me as well about learning about some of these indigenous tribes that in some cases number in the tens of thousands of people living in environments that in many ways managed to preserve and protect and build on their long-held historic traditions, is how many of them, for some of these indigenous groups, these sort of national boundaries that we've established between Brazil and Peru or Colombia or whatnot are not entirely significant to them. And so that tribe you mentioned, their territory actually spans those borderlands in the forest where, because our modern, so-called modern national boundaries allow for a lot of disarray in borderlands, they are often at the center of some terrible conflict, whether it's through trafficking of drugs, human trafficking, or other illicit activity there on those borderlands. There are also many indigenous groups in those very borderlands trying to maintain their way of life. And as you mentioned, trying to keep a safe arm's distance away from the modern world, so to speak.
And so they want to maintain their distance. That doesn't mean that they're ignorant of modern life. They know what
modern life is about, and they
don't want any part of it.
Correct. And I think that, too, is now and then one of these stories will come out, whether it's from Brazil or any of the other forests of the world, in which oftentimes it's mischaracterized as for the first time this tribe makes contact with the outside world. And actually, it's quite the opposite. It's typically that they have had contact with the modern world and learned quite quickly that that's not what they want, insofar as they are living, many of these indigenous groups, with the long and bloody and tragic history of having contact with the outside world be contact that results in death, that results in kidnapping, abduction, all of the worst conceivable things you could imagine happening to your family or to your children, happening to them. And they've learned over time that the outsiders are to be avoided. And so I would say that by no means are they ignorant of the outside world. They're just acutely aware of its dangers.
What is FUNAI? FUNAI. Brazil's National Indian Foundation.
National Indian Protection Foundation. And FUNAI is one of many government agencies in Brazil that's charged with the protection and facilitation and protecting the boundaries of various indigenous groups' territories in Brazil, among other duties and responsibilities. And over the course of its history, it has sort of... it's had a very checkered past. There have been times in Brazil's history where FUNAI was facilitating the forced assimilation of indigenous groups. And over time, as we transitioned into the 80s and 90s, FUNAI became more of an arm for justice and protection of those tribes, especially the most isolated tribes in Brazil. Unfortunately, in recent years, as Brazil has had its own political and economic crisis, FUNAI has been struggling with a lot of its funding, and a lot of that infrastructure that was built is now falling apart. But they're the primary government agency in Brazil responsible for the so-called protection of indigenous groups.
And what is its no-contact policy?
So the no-contact policy in Brazil, which is highly controversial in some circles, is the notion that the best way that these so-called isolated or uncontacted tribes can be protected is to limit contact with them by all means necessary, insofar as not only thinking about the ways that contact with the outside world can affect negatively their culture through the introduction of any number of what you could call cultural pollutants, let alone alcohol, drugs, any sorts of other things, but that in addition, some of these indigenous groups have been living in isolation for so long that even simple disease agents such as the common cold or the flu could prove absolutely deadly and wipe out an entire group. And so the no contact policy has been instituted in an effort to make the baseline of operation being that we will leave these groups alone and do what's possible to defend the borders of their territories and prevent outsiders from coming in. Unfortunately, traffickers and other criminal elements are far more determined and resourced than FUNAI in this respect. And so oftentimes the troubles that we see and the tragedies that we see befall these indigenous groups are the result of traffickers and other criminal elements essentially just circumventing those border protections.
Do the indigenous tribes take on their own defense, or do they rely entirely on FUNAI and the Brazilian government to protect them from these outside forces?
That's a great question. And one thing that I think is really important to underscore is how resourceful and how adaptable and how keen many of these indigenous groups are and capable they are of defending their own territory. For many of them, the best defense is to remain in hiding. For many of them, the best defense is to remain isolated, which is precisely why they've done so. Because oftentimes, if it comes down to matters of combat and physical defense, they're severely outmanned and outgunned. But I would underscore that for many of the indigenous groups and their leaders, defending and protecting their territory and their families and their people is something that they have done capably for centuries. And I think one of the big debates in the field, particularly among anthropologists and activists, is to what degree can we count on that to continue, and to what degree is the march of development and encroachment inevitable?
Yeah, and so what can indigenous people do to prevent, say, logging and deforestation and trafficking and all of these things? Is there anything they can do once, say, a prospector is there on their land looking for raw materials or looking for gold or whatever it is they're looking for?
I mean, that's a really difficult question, and it's one that's also difficult to answer because we have so few. There's not a lot of transparency around those contacts when they do happen. Oftentimes, the media receives reports of such incidents weeks after the fact, after whatever incident has happened has already taken place. But I do know that some of the things that indigenous groups are able to do is take up the mantle where the state has failed them. And in some cases, for example, putting up border demarcations on their territories of their own, rather than relying on FUNAI or other government agencies to demarcate that territory. Or in other cases, there's been some really creative use of, for example, drones. Well, there's one anthropologist, Dr. Robert Walker, who one of the things he advocates for is empowering indigenous groups through the use of technology to be able to survey and protect their own land through the use of technology. And so I think there are some really interesting ways that the creativity and adaptability of indigenous groups can work together with the creativity and adaptability of so-called like modern advocates for their safety. But I think for those indigenous groups that are very much remain in hiding and remain in isolation, I think, wisely so, they feel their best defense is to stay in hiding.
Mm-hmm. Now, during the World Cup, you went with a group of journalists to see a Brazil-Cameroon match with an indigenous tribe, the Tururukari Uka tribe.
Correct, and they are a family unit of the Omagua ethnic group, which is has a long and storied past in Brazil as well.
Okay, and so what describe that experience?
So that experience was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to watch the World Cup in a very curious setting. The tribe, which is a member of the Omagua ethnic group, is one of the groups in Brazil and in Manaus that was working with the state in an effort to try to create a way that their tribe could sustain its economy independently while also preserving some of its cultural heritage and elements. And so the tribe, led by a tremendous young chief named Francisco Uruma, his solution, in cooperation with the state government of Manaus, was to try to essentially create like an ecotourism startup in which he and his family, it's a group of about 65 people living on a small territory outside of Manaus, would be able to welcome outsiders to their village and introduce them to some of their cultural practices, to their song, to their dance. In some of the more out there ideas were, for example, they would facilitate marriage ceremonies. And so you can see this quickly becomes a slippery slope in terms of cultural appropriation. But there were a lot of ideas floating around, some which originated with the tribe, others which originated with outsiders, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But I joined a group. This was essentially a World Cup press tour in which myself and several other international journalists were seeking air conditioning and a change of pace. So got on the bus to go out and enjoy the Brazil-Cameroon match with this tribe. What we got to experience was Francisco and his extended family trying to create a space of their own devising where they could welcome outsiders to their village for the first time and introduce elements of their culture and elements of their heritage on their own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And taking what oftentimes are lessons of culture that visitors find in museums and bringing them to life. And rather than having those lessons brought to outsiders through an interpreter, having them presented to outsiders through the tribe themselves.
In the little bit of time that we have left, and so I take it that whole experience was not otherworldly, but completely different than any experience you had had.
Absolutely. Very, very interesting mixture of the Brazilian Amazon as the government would like to imagine what's possible versus the reality of the Brazilian Amazon from the perspective of mm-hmm. the tribes.
Now, you returned to Manaus after the World Cup to continue to cover Amazonas through your research. You received a letter from the Federal Press Agency in Brasilia, basically trying to deter you. Here's what the letter said. Manaus is undergoing a huge surge in violence with sometimes 6 murders a night. It is a horror. The police rape girls on bus lines. Get out of there, buddy. Indians are a worn-out cliche. How did you feel when you got that letter?
For me, I felt, in a way, validated that the story that I was pursuing was one that people would prefer I didn't tell, which for any journalist is always a feeling
that's
validating.
That's the red cape.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the same time, one of the reasons why I included that email in the book, and I took care not to include that person's name who sent it to me, but was because I feel like that conception of the Brazilian Amazon is not uncommon among Brazilians from other cities in Brazil, which is to say that the interior of the Amazon, even now in 2018, for many Brazilians, remains a backwater, remains something that they are maybe perhaps aware of and curious about, but generally something best left unexplored or uninvestigated. And so for me, I included that as a way of showcasing to the reader as we bridge into that section of the book that covers more of the criminal aspects of life in Manaus, that there are many stories yet to be told in the Amazon, and that many of those stories are ones that Brazilians in its southern cities and capitals and in Brasilia itself would prefer that are better left untold.
And Manaus after the World Cup, how would you describe it?
So the conclusion of the World Cup in Manaus and in Brazil in general, coincided with a worsening of a political and economic crisis in Brazil, in which we really, in the years 2014 to 2016, saw the wheels come off the economy in Brazil, as well as the wheels come off its political system.
Right.
And a lot of those troubles, you know, to be clear, were well in motion before the World Cup, as early as 2012, 2013. But the World Cup at least offered a temporary reprieve from all that. So when I returned to Manaus in 2015 and continued to travel throughout the Amazon and through 2016, what I found was a country and a region really grappling and really reckoning with the aftermath of this rush of development, this rush of capital, of outside visitors that had suddenly exited. And in that way, it really echoed a cycle of boom and bust in the Amazon that's been ongoing since Europeans first arrived. And so what I found in Manaus was a city grappling with tremendous security challenges in terms of organized crime, in terms of police corruption, tremendous political challenges in terms of corruption and collaboration at the highest levels of government between drug traffickers and government leaders, and a city at the same time just trying to retain and remain uniquely itself.
I've been speaking with Chris Feliciano Arnold about his new book, The Third Bank of the River, Power and Survival in the 21st Century Amazon. Tomorrow, June 7th, Chris Feliciano Arnold will be participating in a panel presentation with authors Lauren Markham and Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno at the National Book Foundation Why Reading Matters Conference. For more information, visit a link on our show page on our website, wnyc.org/midday. Chris, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.